Welcome to the Procurement Show.
Hello and welcome to the Procurement Show, the show that tackles the topics we all need to think about and sets out to explore the more interesting bits of procurement. I'm Jonathan O'Brien.
And I'm Paul Philpott. I'm here to squeeze the oranges for Jonathan O'Brien's freshly squeezed orange juice.
For half time.
The Procurement Show is brought to you by Positive Purchasing, enabling the future of procurement in organisations around the globe.
This week, our guest is an inspiring entrepreneur who has single-handedly championed a revolution in healthcare supply chains from his bedroom in Pennsylvania, whilst at university and with no procurement or supply chain experience. He's since graduated from University of Pennsylvania with a Bachelor's of Science in Engineering in Bioengineering and Biomedical Engineering, but not before winning the coveted University of Pennsylvania President's Innovation Prize. He is now CEO and co-founder of Grapevine, a company that uses technology to reimagine the world's medical supply chain challenges. And it all started during the pandemic. Please welcome to the Procurement Show, Luca Yiannopoulos. Luca, welcome. It's really great to have you on the Procurement Show.
Well, it is great to be here, Jonathan. Thank you for having me on.
I love the introduction to that.
And yeah.
If I'm honest, I think the only thing that Jonathan O'Brien managed to achieve in his bedroom...
Don't go there. Don't mention that.
It's either not worth... Well, you wrote your first procurement book, didn't you? At the tender age of 12.
Yeah, earlier. I started at 5. I was really intrigued about this. So we're going back. You sat in your bedroom. A pandemic has descended upon all of us. And you did this incredible thing that really changed the game in terms of healthcare supply chain. So just set the scene. How did it start? What did you do?
There's an age-old saying, and I butchered a little bit, but the idea being necessity is the parent of innovation. I, as Jonathan mentioned, had no background or interest in procurement, and I was in the middle of my studies basically hooking computer chips into cockroaches' brains at University of Pennsylvania when the pandemic hit. My mom is a nurse practitioner. My dad's a scientific researcher. And frankly, I was scared as we started quarantining from our room and seeing terrifying headlines on the news every single night about supply chain failures and the risks that were posed to both patients, people like me, and more importantly, my parents who were on the front line every single day. So me, my buddies in our room, driven a little insane by the repeated headlines, wanted to get involved and wanted to see if there was information out there that could be used to help solve some of these problems or mitigate some of these risks. And that's really why we dove headfirst into, I guess, the procurement world.
Mm-hmm. Now, that as a catalyst for an idea is quite impactful, but I really need to ask you, did you literally have no procurement and supply chain experience, or did you have a little bit that kind of helped you along the way?
No, honestly, none at all. And I wouldn't even have classified for the first year of what I was doing, you know, what I was doing as supply chain or procurement. But now I look back on it and that's exactly what it was. I mean, we started looking at basically databases of information, U.S. Customs and Border import records, overlaying that information and data set with FDA medical license registrars to see who was actually importing products that were regulated and approved by our government agencies. And by taking a look at those two databases, we were able to see sort of verified sources of supplies that were coming into the United States in real time. The bigger sort of systems, the age-old suppliers, the 300-year-old companies here in the US that people had really exclusively relied on for the last, I guess, as long as we've all been around, there were those local shortages, right? There were problems with the McKessons of the world, the Henry Schein's of the world, the Medlines of the world, getting the supplies they needed. But that didn't mean that we were at a total standstill. There were still opportunities to get almost everything you needed. It was just disparate across unknown small sources. And we put those data points together and put them onto a single screen for desperate healthcare workers.
So let me get this right. The traditional approach here would be you go to one of those big companies, they have all the inventories and they source the stuff. They didn't have the stuff because we're in the middle of a pandemic and stuff's not happening. What you did is you figured out where is this stuff? Where is it coming in? Who's got it? Who exists? And you use data to actually find that stuff out. And then How did you go about getting it flowing?
Yeah, you absolutely nailed it, Jonathan, on the setup. And I guess to add a little more color before I do answer your question, there's a $1 trillion almost market here in the United States that is medical supplies and pharmaceuticals. That's the amount of supplies that are purchased by end users every single year. There's huge companies, example being McKesson, that dominate about 300 billion or 30% of that spend power all comes through them. And they, frankly, don't do much other than aggregate it in conveniently located warehouses to resell it, right? Adding big markups. And in a world where third-party logistics and technology is empowering smaller players to work directly with end users, we were able to sort of unlock the power of the upstream suppliers and plug it directly in to end users or unknown sources, right? And sorry, Jonathan, you had a great question and I totally didn't answer. What was that question?
So how did you get it flowing? And the fact that you just thought for the first time, let's figure out what stuff is where. So you use data in a way that people probably haven't used data before because they've not needed to. The big players have not needed to. What you did, you just said, well, this is where the stuff is. This is where it's coming in. This is who's got it. How do we get it flowing so we get that stuff to the front line? How did you do that?
Once we knew where the supplies was and we knew that it was government approved supplies, if you will, from there, we didn't do any special tricks out of the gate, at least not while I was in my college dorm room, right? We actually just used different databases to find the contact information of the verified sources that we had isolated and identified and reached out to them. Old fashioned methods of phone call and email, connected with these people, confirmed that they had stock and connected ultimately the sources of supplies that we had identified to the cared for frontline workers and end users that we knew needed it.
And clearly your mum was on the front line. So when you were doing this, you had your mum in mind in terms of needing this stuff to do a job.
Absolutely. And this is at a moment where all these supply chains were at a standstill, right? So getting things to flow, people were desperate to get things to flow. And where there was an opportunity to sort of reopen the floodgates to get what you needed, then we created that opportunity. Sort of the rest came together on its own, just out of sort of end user demand and need.
It's such an incredible story. Do you think anything has changed since the pandemic in terms of how medical supplies get to where they're needed? Because you painted a picture of things being quite old and staid. Has it changed?
I think that people carry with them the troubles they faced during those times. With that said, there's been a reversion back to the old norm and getting things to flow in a smarter, newer, better way isn't as easy as it once was. And there is an opportunity, even if it means working with a couple of kids in their dorm room, right? People are willing to take it.
Yeah.
Obviously, now people are a little more hoping to stick to the status quo, I guess, avoid change and stick with what they know.
Look, earlier on, you quite rightly so critiqued the heritage brands, the heritage suppliers in this arena. Why do you think these old established companies failed so much? Why do you think they were allowed to fail so much? And how is it that you managed to achieve something so different? And it obviously clearly resonated with the marketplace.
I think that especially in the space of healthcare, people hold on to this idea of if it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? Because with change, there's always risk of that change not being adopted perfectly. And poorly adopted or poorly sort of rolled out change in healthcare is putting real people's real lives at risk. And that's something people, again, they adopt this idea of if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And that's how these legacy companies have been able to sort of last without evolution, without advancement for, in some cases, 300 years.
Let's talk about sustainability, because I'm interested in how that fits, because out of this, your business Grapevine has been born and a new way of being able to get medical healthcare supplies to where they're needed. But where does sustainability fit? Is that part of what you do? And is it the most important thing in terms of medical supplies, in terms of what people are asking for? Or do you think cost is still the driving factor here?
I think it depends on the business. I think there's more motives than just sustainability and cost. There's confidence and resilience. At Grapevine, we maximize the value of your supplier network at the point of purchase. So by linking vendors of your choosing to Grapevine Procurement Portal, you get to shop all of your vendors in one screen. You accumulate a plethora of sources to make your business more resilient to back orders and resistant to price changes or more sustainable, really of your choosing. We use machine learning to redirect spend so you can toggle different preferences within our procurement portal and within your vendor network to train our system to either drive down costs, increase sustainability, flag high-risk vendors to tell you where you could sort of connect with new people instead because you're seeing consistent delays, or even drive diversity, equity, and inclusion.
The Procurement Show, exploring the more interesting bits about procurement. And now, the procurement fun fact. This edition's exciting tale of preposterous procurement, bizarre buying, or simply saucy sourcing.
Procurement is one of the oldest professions in the world. Historical accounts show bartering and early trade was introduced earlier than 6000 BC by Mesopotamia tribes and later adopted by the Phoenicians, who bartered goods with people in other cities and across oceans. Early traders would have traded animals and later tools, cooking pots, and weapons. Yet many believe procurement is older than this, perhaps as early as 900,000 years ago, when our prehistoric ancestors traded animal skins or services for food. So, the early procurement professionals walked around in animal skins, carried clubs, had long hair, and hadn't yet learned to speak. Some can still be found today sending out RFPs in big companies.
The procurement fun fact. Contact us by email, hello@theprocurementshow.com. Send us a tweet, @procurementshow, or connect with us on LinkedIn. Search for The Procurement Show.
I want to use the term disruptor.
Yes.
And I'm not talking about Jonathan O'Brien at a barbecue, which is normally...
Yeah, that's true.
The term market disruptor, I think it's fair to say that probably applies to you. Do you agree with that? And is there like a risk it just distills things down to basically being nothing more complicated than the lowest cost? So other elements are overlooked and forces people to make decisions that may not be the right ones? Or is it kind of like a course correction that is ripping the old market up and forcing big companies to perhaps change their outlook on how they do things?
I also think that we're a disruptor. And if Grapevine scales and consumes sort of the marketplace or spend that exists today, right, we'll be able to cut the overall spend from the $1 trillion I mentioned before to about $500 billion. We cut spend within any healthcare businesses company by more than 50%, and we do it like clockwork. With that said, we're a disruptor from a bird's eye view. We don't want to be a disruptor in the way that people actually execute their procurement processes. And we got this concept at Grapevine. We call it 11:59 p.m. You guys might call it, I guess, 23:59 over in the UK. We understand that the future can be scary, right? A tomorrow that you don't quite understand or it's different from today, it could displace you. You might not know where it's going and if you'll continue to be important and remembered, if the processes that you put in place, the systems that you built, will continue to withstand the test of time. And I think we all want to feel valued, and we don't want to just throw away the status quo and replace it with a new norm, and even if that new norm is better. So at Grapevine, we talk about this concept of 11:59. If you can meet the customer where they're at, if you can bring them to the edge of today, show them that even with disruption, their processes can stay intact, the great things they've built can stay preserved, that's how you really disrupt an industry from a bird's eye view. So we're a disruptor at a bird's eye view, but we are the status quo in preserving the important qualities of what people have already made.
That's brilliant.
I want to ask you about this concept, Jonathan. It seems that the explanation of being a disruptor within the healthcare sector, of allowing healthcare organizations to get more for their money, makes sense to me. That sounds like a really, really good thing. But with regards to the procurement industry and its view on the concept of a market disruptor, is that commonly seen as being a positive or a negative approach?
It's a great question, because here there's two bits of disruption going on. There's disruption of a traditional marketplace where big suppliers have dominated, enjoyed big margins, and had it just great. Thank you very much. Don't upset the status quo. But there's also the technological disruption of being able to use data in a different way. Now, in terms of what procurement people are looking for right now, you know, they're looking for, it was cost, now it's sustainability and it's resilience and it's being able to know that companies that I'm doing business with tomorrow are going to be there. So that's what people want first and foremost. So if there's disruption to get to that, then procurement people are looking for that. Cost is always going to be key. you know, whatever you do. But you need cost with sustainability, you need cost with security of supply and so on. And we're seeing a change, you know, since the pandemic, we've seen a change in what people are looking for. And there's now a recognition that people need more data, more understanding of what's going on. So I think disruptor is being the right disruptor in this marketplace right now absolutely hits the sweet spot, which I think is, you know, why what you're doing is so interesting, Luca, because for me, this is the holy grail. Because in procurement, you're always looking to get that intelligence of what is the lowest price. Remember, we don't know what the lowest price is when we're going into a negotiation. What is the real price? Where should we be getting this to? And where is the stuff? And that's been impossible, but yet, Luca, you seem to have done this. You seem to have created that thing procurement people have been looking for. I mean, how did you do that?
A lot of these sort of new technologies talk about displacing procurement personnel, right? Like, you don't need accounts payable people, and changing the way that these ends of the supply chain really operate. That's not what we want to do. We want to get procurement people a promotion by making them look like superstars within their workplace. The procurement person is responsible for driving 50% savings on their existing supply chain, for unlocking new vendors and plug and playing every time they order to make sure it's the best price or from the sort of source of preference. That's our goal. And that's what we mean when we say 1159. Mm-hmm. Everything before that in the supply chain, the distributors, the actual like logistics of things, the connections, that all can change. And that is what we are disrupting, is sort of reconfiguring your supply chain to not be a linear chain that is as strong as its weakest link, as weak as its weakest link, right? But turning it into more of a robust network and letting these procurement people shop an infinite number of suppliers, indistinguishable from it being a single one, but getting the value of that broader network without any extra effort.
Luca, you've been bold enough to name them and you've been open enough to give us some specific examples of what you're doing. Has there been a backlash from the big players in this market?
In short, yes, there is a backlash. What I'll say is a lot of the big players, it's not a secret, they're self-preservationists and anti-progress companies. You've got the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, it's all over the news and the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times every single week. But the Federal Trade Commission has opened massive investigations into sort of monopoly and antitrust breaching policies against these very companies. So you look up FTC investigation, healthcare supply chains, and you will find hundreds of articles on it. It's not a secret. They're not just sort of pushing back against us. They're really trying to hold an entire marketplace a century or two in the past. And it's, according to our policies, potentially criminal. So I'll let the FTC decide and our federal government decide what to do with them.
And arguably not limited to healthcare either.
No, that's right. If this is happening in healthcare, and you know this is happening in other sectors as well, especially where you've got these big dominant players that are either sort of channels or distributors in some way or are supplying entities. Because you mentioned the word self-preservation there. That's what happens. And if people get that foothold, it's very difficult to break it sometimes. But that's what we in procurement do. And a lot of this seems to be based around data. And right at the start, you sort of talked about what you did from your dorm room in that you looked at the import data, you looked at the federal trade data, and you started figuring stuff out. And that doesn't sound like rocket science, but yet clearly other people hadn't been doing that stuff. So I guess the question is, you know, how have you approached the data thing? What data is out there? How hard is it to go and get that data and then do something meaningful with it?
Some of the data is easy to get and beautifully standardized. And obviously, to do anything meaningful with data, you need it to be in a usable, standardized format. Some of the other data is locked away or built in old data systems from a time before I was born, the 80s, the 90s. I've learned things called EDI, which were technologies for data that were invented before I was born. They don't teach it in school. I've had to learn it on the job. And
right, that's
a lot of
that's cool. Made me feel really old because I can remember EDI being brought in and having to check out with our suppliers that they had capability to do electronic data interchange.
My heart just sank when you said data examples.
I'm sorry, guys.
From
so
the 80s and 90s.
I was thinking, hey, that was my era. That was it. And now I just feel ancient
just
and old.
Give it to me on a floppy disk, everyone. Sorry, Luca, as you were.
Go ahead.
Buddy, as you were.
No. Point is, some of the data is published in public databases by the government or by different sort of giant entities, and some of it's locked away and a little harder to access. And a huge part of our journey has been accessing the right data putting it into sort of the right format to be able to process it and make it useful for the procurement personnel at the end of the supply chain. And there's definitely been challenges there. You talk about the pushback. One of the pushback points is people trying to make their data less accessible to us. So their customers can't sort of easily make the right choice at the point of purchase, but instead they're locked into either using the portal from the single supplier that they want to work with or not working with that supplier at all. When you hold 33% of the market hostage, it's pretty damn hard to operate without that data.
Completely agree. I mean, Jonathan remembers when binary was revolutionary.
Do you remember?
Yeah.
It's time to Ask Jonathan.
And today's Ask Jonathan comes from Naomi Rogers in the UK, who asks, "Dear Jonathan, can you explain what anchoring is in negotiation and who should go first when starting a position?"
Thank you, Naomi. It's a really good question. Anchoring is when one party in a negotiation sets out a position in some way, and everything else, all the other discussions from that point, are centered around that position. It's like dropping an anchor. We sometimes call it a line in the sand. So you might have a situation where one side goes first and puts a position down. So one side selling something, one side's buying something. The side selling says, "I'm looking for £100, euros, dollars for this." And that's then a kind of a line in the sand. And so then the negotiations will be centered around that point. So the person that's then trying to buy that says, "That's too much money," and will then make a counter based on creating a distance from that bit. "Now, it's too much money. I want it for 50, and perhaps she'll settle on 75. If it's a sort of barter type negotiation. The point with that is that the negotiation endpoint is based around where you've started, which is why anchors are really important. If you know what the right price that you need to pay for something is, anchors are okay because you know where you need to get to. But most of the time in negotiation, we don't. So we're kind of working on the other side wants this. That means I've got to kind of get something that's a little bit more towards where I want to get to. The thing about anchors is the other side will skillfully put anchors to try and get you towards the place they want to get you, which is not where they've dropped their anchor, where they put the line in the sand, but maybe actually the point where you end up. So if the anchor starts at 100, you counter at 50, and you settle at 75, you feel like you've got a really good deal, but actually the other side could have set that up in a way that actually 75 is the price they wanted to get you to in the first place. Now, we kind of see this a bit with things where there is negotiation over list price. So if you're buying a car or something like that, where there would be some negotiation, you know, the list price is the anchor, and then any discount from that makes you feel like you've got a good deal. But of course, you know, you're always going to negotiate. Or in any negotiation where we are trading, if you have intelligence as to where the right price is, you can manage that kind of anchoring. But if you don't, be careful of anchoring, because it is a tactic based on fairness and reciprocity that means we kind of settle in the middle somewhere typically. And the second part of the question was, who should go first? Well, somebody's got to go first. If you're certain of your position, you can go first. If you really don't know what the right kind of place to start is, then you shouldn't go first and let your opponent go first. But just be aware there's a thing called over anchoring, where you kind of go to an extreme position as a means to sort of work back. The trick to this is having intelligence and bearing in mind that any first position is an anchor to get you to kind of center around that point. It doesn't mean it's the right place to start.
Obviously, you've used some simple examples by way of providing a simple explanation. But this concept can still be used for strategic negotiations, negotiating on much bigger things.
Absolutely. I've talked about price, but you know, there's all sorts of negotiables that we might have when we're negotiating. It could be around terms, it could be around warranties, it could be around lead times. You know, whatever the thing we're negotiating is, there'll be our position and there'll be the position that they lay out. And the moment somebody says, "This is the thing that I want, this is the parameter I want," then that is an anchor, and you have to decide whether you're going to negotiate around that or whether you're going to go further away or where you need to end up. So just be alert to anchoring, but it's also a very good tactic that you can use to start the negotiation off to get people where you want them to get to.
And great question, Naomi. If you've got a question that you'd like to ask Jonathan, here's how to get in touch.
Ask Jonathan. Email your question to jonathan@theprocurementshow.com. You might be part of the next show. The Procurement Show. The latest thinking, the greatest insights.
Now, I think it's about time I mentioned...
No, stop, hold back.
I think we've been talking about data, so it's a relevant point to bring it in.
Do
okay?
it gently.
Okay, what about AI?
Oh, there it is.
We're powered by AI, but I have got some strong opinions about the use of the term AI. So AI has meant a lot of things throughout time, right? Mm-hmm. AI has been defined in its most true form, the words AI, I mean, technology that does something better than a human can, right? Like any task. And it evolved into things like automation and robotics. And in the last decade, you know, machine learning. We're using bits and pieces of all of that. And everything we're doing, I guess, can be classified AI. And part of what we're doing can be sort of called the machine learning predictive analytics and the AI in its newest rage form. These systems need people. We are decades, if not centuries, if not never going to happen away from this concept of like AGI or artificial general intelligence and the ability to have computer systems that do everything better than people. AI, grapevine, any technology out there is a tool that can only be wielded by a smart person behind it that knows how to use it. And anyone that tells you otherwise has a, I don't know, there's some sort of scam artist, in my opinion.
Yeah. No, that's a really good way of putting it, actually. Yeah. We also talk a lot on this show about the future of intake systems. So just to remind everybody what that is. So the idea is that you've got a system, you have something you need to source, you kind of put it into the field or the bot, and it knows in real time the best way to source it, the best way to get it, what's happening in the marketplace at that point in time, what's happening in terms of geopolitical stuff around the world, and can figure out this is the best way to source it, this is the right price to pay, this is the supply chain that's going to supply it. So in terms of grapevine, would you say that you are an intake system or heading to be that in terms of the future? So there is kind of one point where you want to source something and you guys can do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's think about this in the scope of one customer and then like the broader customer base of grapevine. So when you look at one customer in grapevine, we like to preserve the status quo, at least initially, the most important parts of it. And when a customer comes to Grapevine or a procurement team comes to Grapevine, right, they link their different vendors and Grapevine immediately begins optimizing the smartest source for every product they purchase when they place an order. Now imagine you've got hundreds of different but similar companies all doing this, right? All purchasing the same products, but each bringing new sources to the table. As company one shops, optimizes from the smartest source that they already know, we see patterns, we compare it to what company two through 2000 do. And we say, hey, you've been buying this product for a while, but there are 17 other companies that also purchase this product, either directly from the manufacturer or from a smarter source at a lower price. And the source that you're buying from, frankly, isn't a big winner when people link these other suppliers. Would you like to unlock these four other suppliers? That alone can cut your spend without even changing the SKU or the product line. That alone can cut your spend by another 30%. And that's exactly what we do.
So that leads me to ask the question then. And we did kind of touch on other industries earlier, but I want to ask you explicitly, can this work for other sectors than medical?
I don't see why not. We have a few people using this in crazy other spaces, from like horse feed and livestock feed space to whatever. Yeah, I mean, I don't see why not. I think that obviously the status quo for different markets, different spaces, it varies, right? What people need. I don't think this is a consumer sort of platform for a lot of reasons. But yeah, I think this could be applied to other spaces.
What about your thoughts?
What, can it be applied to the horse feed sector? Yeah, absolutely. I'm still back trying to think of a funny thing to say to your unfunny gag there.
Thank you. I ignore yours. You might as well ignore mine.
I know. Yeah. Absolutely. Because the interesting thing here is, I don't want to take it down to the lowest common denominator here. What you've done is you've taken data, you figured out how you can cut through all of the traditional people that are doing self-preservation, and you found a way to be able to source things better and get things moving. Of course, that can apply to any sector. I think the key here is being able to understand that marketplace. I'm guessing that the reason why the Grapevine is focused on medical is because that's a big enough thing. It's a big enough challenge in its own to do that. So to do that in other sectors, if you can understand that marketplace, understand the data, which is what we do in procurement, the moment you understand the marketplace, you can then start figuring out how you can source it better, how you can get those supply chains working. But it's all about that knowledge. So there's a risk you sort of spread yourself too thin and try and say that this is a general thing. Being able to focus very specific on industry verticals is the bit that gives an edge here. That would be my take on it. Luca, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree, especially because it's a highly regulated space. We're not just doing this with like masks and gloves, the things that pop into mind, right, when you think of the pandemic, but we're doing this with pharmaceuticals and drugs. And there's a huge amount of regulations that need to be tended to in that space. And we're trying to sort of crowdsource smarter supply networks for each and every company from the entire sort of system of companies that exist in Grapevine. And to do that, right, to add value, the doctors aren't getting value from the horse feed, guys. I'll tell you that much, right? So if we're crowdsourcing and aggregating data, it's smart to focus on a specific niche, play within the regulations in this highly regulated space, and continue sort of delivering the most value from customer one to customer 2000.
So what's the future of this? Where does healthcare, where does what you do get to in the next 5 years?
From the bird's eye view, I think that in 5 years, we can make a significant impact, you know, cutting this entire country's spend on these sort of supplies by somewhere between 10 and 20%. That would be our goal. But I guess even more than that, I want it to be felt not just by the procurement people, the hospitals on their budget sheets. I want it to be felt by patients like me. When I go to the doctor, I want to notice that my bills are lower because of what we're able to accomplish. And right now, and it's a little different, I know, in your guys' part of the world, and you guys might even laugh at what we do and what we have to pay as patients. But right now, I'm sick, I get an IV, or I have to get my foot stitched up, and you get this bill and an IV solution, $400 in some cases. I'm looking at it in the system of Grapevine, and I can see that that thing is $4. Yeah. So what the hell is going on here? I want to be able to impact every single person that goes to a doctor's office and drive down the cost that we actually get to pay as people.
And the challenges you just outlined here, I mean, although, you know, you're in the US and you're talking about some of the US challenges in healthcare, we've done a lot of work with the US healthcare companies. So I understand that kind of big player dominance there. There's a similar issue in the UK, although we're not paying for the IV bag because we've got the wonderful NHS here in the UK. But the health sector here still has those same challenges because we work in that sector as well. And there are still these big dominant players. There is still lack of understanding, lack of consistency of what the price of an IV bag should be from one, we call them trusts here, one trust, one business unit effectively, to another. And you will find they're all paying different prices because procurement hasn't managed to be able to get that stuff sorted. So it is a global issue. It's a global issue because medical supplies, healthcare supplies, that's big business. Yeah. And so there are big dominant players that want to hold on to that position.
And also, it's like one in the UK, from a consumer point of view, we just don't understand it. I mean, I was Googling a very similar subject the other day, and it's something like, if I buy a Ventolin inhaler, I'm asthmatic in the UK, and I buy it wholly privately, it's under £30 for an inhaler at the most. And I Googled the US, and it was something like $250 to $300.
Wow.
For an inhaler. I don't know if that was an errored result, but it definitely stood out on the page. I'm thinking, no way, that can't be the case. I want to move the conversation onto our closing and ask you, hopefully you don't pay that much for takeaways over there. But let's twist the question for your top three takeaways as a result of this discussion today.
There's a potential opportunity to do good beyond the borders of the US. That's probably my top takeaway. And because of sort of the international criticism that I think the US gets in our own healthcare system, I haven't always sort of seen or understood that. That's a big takeaway for me. Two would be the solution I think can be and maybe should be applied to other spaces, not as a priority, but when the opportunity comes, I think we could start segmenting and looking at other markets. That's another big takeaway. And three, that the UK needs better Wi-Fi.
Just to give some context to that, normally when we record these, the connection is perfect, but the whole of the internet has just broken here in the UK, and we've done it on Paul's phone, basically.
Yeah. And I'm going to blame Jonathan.
Yeah, but it's worked, hasn't it? Not a single glitch. It's been a delight to talk to you and really impressed with the story of how you drove massive change from your bedroom during COVID and with no procurement experience, which just goes to show that actually sometimes you just got to think differently about stuff. So thank you so much for being on The Procurement Show. It's been a delight to have you on. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, gentlemen. Have a lovely weekend.
You've been listening to The Procurement Show. Contact us by email, hello@theprocurementshow.com. Connect with us on LinkedIn, search for The Procurement Show, and on Twitter at Procurement Show. Visit us at theprocurementshow.com. The Procurement Show is brought to you by Positive Purchasing, enabling the future of procurement in organisations around the globe. Copyright Positive Purchasing, all rights reserved. Produced by Fresh Air Studios.